Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and his kingdom. We have been very concerned for now weeks, it seems, about something that might have escaped notice altogether, but for the work of an intrepid investigative journalist, I think we might call him, James Rogowski, who caught wind of something that the Biden administration was up to with respect to the World Health Organization that it hadn't made much notice of, I think it's fair to say, and seemingly was hoping that nobody would understand what it was up to. James did. He blew the whistle on it. An awful lot of people got engaged as a result. And we saw an extraordinary thing happen last week at the World Health Assembly, the member nations of the World Health Organization, which is, I think is all of the nations of the world. And we wanted to catch up with Jim to find out what actually happened. We're going to talk about that, whether this is a signal victory, a stay of execution, or something else. And then we'll talk in the next block with him about the way forward. James Rogowski, it's so good to have you with us, and thank you for what you did in the intervening period since we last spoke to really bird dog relentlessly what was going on in Geneva, mostly behind closed doors, but bringing it to the rest of us. And now I'm hoping to help interpret what took place. It's good to have you back. Welcome.
Thanks for having me. And Frank, you were one of the early people, you know, to give me a chance to share the word with everyone. So thank you for that. Diving right into it, because there's just so much information. To recap what has happened in this past week, in the past couple of months, as you said, the Biden administration had proposed amendments to international health regulations, and they were to be considered during the World Health Assembly, which happened from May 22nd to May 28th in Geneva. And so, you know, we had spoken about that, you know, through the past couple of months to try to get people to be aware of what was, you know, they were hoping to do nice and quietly. But obviously, the word spread and, you know, something good went viral. And everyone that, you know, we talked to helped spread the word. What happened in Geneva was wonderful in the sense that it was an absolute, complete, and total demolishing of what Biden had proposed and planned. His proposal just never saw really the light of day. It was always hanging there. You know, the document never got retracted.
But before you go there, Jim, let's just do a little bit of groundwork laying again, because some folks may have missed our previous conversations. But what was it in these amendments? Amendments to international health regulations sounds like a pretty, pedestrian operation, but it was very high stakes in the end. And thank you for calling it out. But in what way?
Well, very boring until you actually look at it and you understand it. And what would happen with people is, I do think I have a skill in reading things that are incredibly complicated, but getting to the important point. And so the important point was they wanted to remove 10 words from one of the articles of the regulations. And those 10 words essentially said that if the WHO was to think about declaring an international emergency, that the nation in question would have the last word. Well, they wanted to remove that, which would have allowed what I refer to as the dictator general of the World Hypnosis Organization to just declare an emergency anytime for any reason, whatever the heck he wanted. Now,
but on this, it's supposed to be a public health emergency, but it turns out that was going to be left up to his discretion too. No,
and so it amounted to, you know, arguably a document that had it been approved or adopted could have been seen, you know, in history as the founding document of the Great Reset, where the authority would have gone from each individual nation to one man. And, you know, anybody who looked at the information could see very clearly that that was not a good idea.
Right. Well, and especially based on his performance to date, what I call Pandemic 1.0, not a particularly encouraging role that he played, principally, as I understand it, Jim, promoting the direction, really, not so much of the dictator general, as you say, but of the Chinese Communist Party. Would that be fair?
Yeah, it's bad enough to give up your sovereign nation's authority voluntarily to one person, but let alone that particular person. And so anyone who, you know, took the time to look at the information, you could hear the sound of the light bulb go off in their head when they comprehended what they were seeing, and the fire in the belly of, you know, not just Americans, but people around the world. They're like, oh, this is just absolutely, you know, not something that we can accept. And so the word spread. And obviously what happened was the people who were involved as delegates to the World Health Organization's assembly most likely actually read Biden's proposal. And what ultimately happened before the assembly even got started was they were unable to reach a consensus, which is diplomatic terms for somebody was very unhappy. And so on Tuesday morning, when the committee and the assembly were supposed to discuss this topic, a whole new document was presented, completely new document. So Biden's proposals were pretty much kicked to the curb at that point. And this new document got debated Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and on Friday morning, it was resubmitted with a few changes to the new document. And late in the day Friday, through a process that wasn't actually voting the way people think of it, they achieved unanimous consent. And much to my surprise, it went in the exact opposite direction and gave more sovereignty and more authority to the individual nations. And so it was the cherry on top of a stunning defeat for Biden's administration. And so it was very much a soap opera. On my Substack, jamesroguski.substack.com, there's an article entitled We Win, and I clipped out and made it so that people don't have to watch a whole week's worth of boring, meetings and all that sort of stuff. But when certain delegates spoke, the Russian delegate, the Iranian delegate, the Namibian delegate, the delegate from Brunei and Botswana and many other nations, clearly they saw that it was a power grab. And they weren't having any of it.
Going to go down that road of submitting to the diktat of the dictator general of the World Health Organization. Jim Roguski, we're going to come back after a very short break to talk about what comes next and what it'll mean for all of us. Will the Biden team have their way in the end or not? Stay tuned. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. We seem to have dodged a bullet last week at the World Health Assembly. No, it wasn't the 9mm kind President Biden wants to restrict. Rather, it was one Team Biden aimed at our sovereignty via proposals to let a proxy for the Chinese Communist Party dictate what constitute public health emergencies of international concern and what we'll do about them. Unfortunately, world government types are sure to resurface this gambit in the future. Worse yet, the global resetters simultaneously meeting in Davos unveiled two new digital mechanisms for imposing their totalitarian ambitions. As a courageous freedom fighter named Dr. Naomi Wolf has warned for over 2 years, such vaccine passports will inevitably usher in what the CCP calls a social credit system. Her brilliant new book, The Bodies of Others, is an instant bestseller and required reading for American patriots. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. Jim Roguski is in the house virtually. We are catching up with him after a very long week spent monitoring the to-ing and fro-ing of the World Health Assembly on some incredibly arcane topics and bureaucraties and diplomaties that would be incomprehensible, I think, to the mere mortal. Jim, I think you're absolutely right. You do have a gift for making sense of it all, and thank you for doggedly doing it and relaying it to the rest of us, because it was an indispensable resource, I know, for this program and I think for lots of others besides. I did want to say, I think you mentioned that at your Substack platform, you had some clips. I just happened to tune in to one of an American delegate going on and on in the most impenetrable way imaginable. I mean, it was just almost a parody of what diplomats tend to do these days. But you've given us a sense that something very momentous took place here when, thanks in no small measure to your good self, the alarm was raised worldwide that this was a massive effort to migrate sovereignty and you know, in many cases at least, accountability from national governments to this deeply flawed international organization. And I just got to tell you, my every experience tells me this is not likely to be the last word. The people who brought us this, the great resetters, as you say, the Chinese Communist Party, for that matter, don't take defeat lying down as a general rule. So give us a sense of what you think the lay of the land is now, what's coming next, and most importantly, Jim, what should listeners to programs like this, patriotic Americans who love this constitutional republic and want to preserve it for their posterity, what are they to do to try to make sure this does come out right?
I will give the punchline at the very beginning, okay? All of the information, you can go to stopthewho.com. Now, don't do a search for that because your search engine will send you off to who knows where. Just type in http://stopthewho.com. And it actually takes me back to a couple of months ago, starting at the end of February and March. I was researching something that is different than what we were talking about in the earlier segment. I was researching something that is referred to as the proposed pandemic treaty. And so if you go to stopthewho.com, you'll see an article that I wrote on March 24th. And the pandemic treaty is the soup to nuts, A to Z, throw in the kitchen sink. If you wanted to be the dictator of the world, what would you throw in there so that you could just control everyone's life from top to bottom? And so it's almost
on the assumption there will be another pandemic, and that pandemic will then cause your powers to be, instigated for the purpose of telling everybody what to do.
In the Constitution of the WHO, not the United States Constitution, but the WHO Constitution, they define, the fact that the WHO is in charge of health. And so that makes sense given the name. But when you actually really think about health, you know, every aspect of your life, every aspect of society could loosely be interpreted as having an impact on your health. So they want to control.
We saw that with the China model being implemented at Tedros's direction
so they're seeking to control absolutely everything. And so the path forward in the short run is we really don't have to worry for the next year, because they meet once a year, about amendments to the regulations. That battle has been won, you know, outlandishly, wonderfully well. The course now changes to focusing on their negotiations for something called a pandemic treaty, which currently, publicly anyways, does not exist. And they're shooting for August 1st to publish their first draft of the quote-unquote pandemic treaty. They may rename it the pandemic accords, think the Paris Climate Accords, you know, that type of all-encompassing document. The immediate action is going to be to learn about what this is all about. So if you go to stopthewho.com, you can see there are absolutely millions of words that have been written about the topic, and you don't have to read them all. You just have to get the general idea. And they have scheduled for June 16th and the 17th a public comment period. Now, they haven't specifically given us the details of how we submit those comments. They'll probably be coming in the next week or so. And oh my goodness, are they going to get a firestorm of comments from around the world?
Well, let's talk about what you're going to be commenting on if you participate in this firestorm. And I certainly agree with you that it's in order. Whether it's these amendments, whether it's the pandemic treaty, whether it's any other manifestation of this grand design to create a global government, this being just one of the building blocks, but perhaps the leading one. And one of the things that was striking about this past week, as you know, Jim Rogowski, was that the World Economic Forum was meeting in parallel up the road in Davos, Switzerland. And at the same time that people were fulminating about how much sovereignty they were going to steal from member nations, you heard several presentations that were very ominous indeed, and we talked about this yesterday with Reggie Littlejohn. One is this so-called global personal carbon footprint tracker, and another is something that was apparently commissioned by the World Health Organization from T-Mobile, now a German-owned company, to manufacture universal digital health ID cards or some vaccine passport or whatever they're going to call it. Talk about those aspects of the agenda and whether they are, in fact, further evidence of the relentless pursuit of this idea that national sovereignty and autonomy and accountability are really endangered species as long as these guys are at work.
Well, you know, anyone who has a job as a public servant and has sworn an oath to defend the Constitution against enemies domestic and foreign, you're talking about enemies that, you know, are in a foreign land, but many of our congresspeople attended the World Economic Forum meeting. And, you know, the real enemies are the people who hold office here in the United States that are implementing, as we speak, the types of agendas that you're talking about. And so what is going on with this intergovernmental negotiating body that was set up in December as part of the WHO is it appears that they believe that health is the centerpiece of how they can gain control. If you don't have their injections, if you don't have, you know, whatever it is they decide, then you don't get to participate in their beast system, where if you don't do what they want to do, or if you don't do what they want you to do, then you cannot participate in society according to them. And so the real danger is our local officials who somehow believe that the World Health Organization has any authority to do anything other than make a recommendation. Those recommendations are not obligations. And when our local officials get that wrong, they cause the problem.
Jim, you're so right on this. And again, I think it is violative of their oaths in office. We have to let you go with that. We'll be back with more questions for you, I know, and look forward to our further visit. Jim Roguski, thank you for your great work on all of this. Keep it up and do report back soon. Next up, Chris Chmielewski joins us from Numbers USA to talk about border insecurity, the invasion underway now. Stay tuned.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa: Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa: Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and I'm always pleased to be able to say an organization that I have admired tremendously for its work on immigration issues is represented with us today by Chris Chmielewski. He is the deputy director of Numbers USA. He runs its grassroots networks, which are formidable, and he is also responsible for one of the most important scorecards in Washington, D.C., and that is Numbers' reckoning of who is behaving responsibly and the many who are not when it comes to matters involving border security and the interior security of our country in the Numbers portfolio. And Chris, it's always good to have a chance to catch up with you, even though usually it's an opportunity to bemoan the starry state of affairs. And I think that's what we're going to be doing again today, right?
Right. Thanks for having me back, Frank. And always good to be here.
Thank you. Well, it's always a pleasure to have you, even if the tidings are grim. Let me ask you, as a guy who specializes in numbers, to give us your current update on the numbers of people that are coming to this country illegally, both those that we are actually confident we know their numbers and the estimates of those that are the so-called getaways.
Yeah. Well, we had a record-setting month back in April with 234,000. They call them encounters. That's a combination of both Border Patrol apprehensions, but also people who are inadmissible but present themselves to customs agents at port of entries. It's a bit deceiving just because the government's really only been tracking this number dating back to about 2000. So we know that there were really high numbers as well in the 90s. But still, 235,000, the highest number in 2 decades, is pretty large. About 3/4 of them are single adults. And that's concerning for its own reason. But we've got about another 36,000 family units and about 11 or 12,000 unaccompanied minors who make up that larger number.
And when you say single adults, 3/4 of them, how many of those are male single adults of, well, military age, perhaps?
Right, probably almost all of them. Now, the somewhat good news is that at least in April, the Biden administration turned away about 92,000, mostly of those single adult males, due to the Title 42 restrictions. But we know that they're lifting those, so that's going to come to an end. And still, the question
is, there's a federal judge who said no, but you anticipate that will be overcome and that they will be back in business with a surge that is hard to imagine how much worse this will be.
Right, I do, because we're still talking about a discretionary power. So just because a judge says that they have to keep Title 42 in place, and as we've seen, we had of those 234,000 total encounters, 200,000 of them were actual apprehensions by Border Patrol along the border. Only 93,000 of them were turned away under Title 42. So the administration is using some discretion there on who they apply Title 42 to, and all they're going to do is they're going to continue to shrink that field so it applies to almost no one. Yeah, they can still say it's in place, but it's not impacting anybody.
Right. It's honored in the breach, as they say. Chris, when you talk about the Biden administration's policies, this is clearly purposeful. They have essentially ripped up by the roots the policies that were in place under the Trump administration and that largely made this a containable, if still challenging, issue of border security. My friend and colleague Steve Bannon has talked a lot about the numbers involved as really being multiples of a D-Day style invasion. Is invasion the right term to use, do you think, to describe what's happening to our country now?
I mean, invasion is a pretty strong word, but the only reason why I stopped short of calling it invasion is because we have an administration that's allowing that are welcoming these folks. So
uncontested invasion.
Right. So you don't typically welcome invaders. But, you know, I think President Biden was certainly, when he campaigned back in 2020, he made it pretty clear that he didn't support mass enforcement, that he was going to use targeted enforcement, and that his approach to border security was definitely less than what we've seen from President Trump, but even less than what we saw under the Obama era. But essentially what he's done is he's put somebody in Alejandro Mayorkas in charge of DHS, and Secretary Mayorkas is pretty much as close to open borders as you can get. So, you know, when you have somebody who's leading the immigration efforts here in the country in Mayorkas, I can see why people want to call it an invasion, but at the same time, we're inviting it. So the policies of the Biden administration are certainly inviting these folks to come here.
Well, that makes all the more egregious what's happening, of course. But I want to get at the underbelly of that welcoming, because I don't think we get nearly enough information about this. And I think for many of us, what's happening at the border is still not as clear as you've just made it, Chris. But talk a little bit about what happens when these people get here. It's my understanding that they are being essentially disseminated all over the United States. And I'm just trying to figure out, what happens to them then? They're obviously wards of the state, I guess, but who's picking up the tab and how sizable is it?
Yeah. Well, when we consider the fact that in April alone, you had 201,000 apprehensions and by Border Patrol officers, and then only about 92,000 of them were expelled. So that leaves another 102 or 108,000 that are being relocated into the United States. And the Biden administration isn't exactly being very, very candid about where they're sending these folks. So if it weren't for a couple of noisy governors, we wouldn't know where these people are going. We know a lot of them are being sent to Florida, but they're being sent to the interior all across this country. Which brings up the old adage, every state is a border state right now. And it's true because they're relocating these illegal border crossers everywhere. Tremendous burden on taxpayers. A lot of them come with a couple of bucks in their back pocket, and that's about it. So what are they going to do? They're going to take jobs that Americans could be working instead. They're going to take that money under the table, and they're going to probably rely on some government services to make ends meet.
So let me just make sure I get this straight. You're saying that they are eligible to work, or they're simply going to work illegally. They'll make up whatever shortfalls they find, and presumably they're considerable, with subventions of various kinds. And it's not just living expenses. Is it housing? Is it education? Is it healthcare? What else is involved?
So what we're seeing is that many of the folks that are coming in that aren't being subjected to Title 42, even though Title 42 really prevents folks from applying for asylum, there are still some that are applying for asylum and getting through that. And once they apply for asylum, they can get a work authorization in about 30 to 90 days. And then others are being paroled for humanitarian reasons, most likely because they claim that they have a close family member somewhere in the United States. So they're getting work documents. So a lot of these folks, we're a big champion in mandating E-Verify nationwide to help control illegal immigration. Unfortunately, this is one
example. This is a mechanism whereby employers can certify that people are legally here. Is that
their workers are authorized to work in the United States, right? But this is one of those situations where E-Verify probably wouldn't deter most of these illegal border crossings because the Biden administration is giving them EADs, employment authorization documents. As for the public benefits, because of their status, they may not be able to access direct like SNAP payments or housing subsidies. But what's happening is the government is giving block grants to religious charity groups, other NGOs that are then providing these benefits, these taxpayer benefits to the illegal aliens.
So it's still coming out of the taxpayer's pocket. It's just being channeled through these outfits, which, let's face it, do it for profit, charitable organizations, though they may be, or religious ones for that matter. Chris, this is very ominous, I have to say. And just to tie these two pieces together, you're talking about people we don't know exactly what their intent is in a lot of cases. They're military age males in most cases. They're being disseminated across our country into, black holes, certainly in the dark of night. What could possibly go wrong, I guess, is the question. Is it possible that we could see, terrorism or worse at their hands?
And I apologize for laughing, but that's basically the situation that we've come into. It's like it's the only way you can look at it is
come into. We've been brought into by this administration. Let's be fair.
You know, one of the things that I want to point out is not just the folks that might be the possible threats that might be hidden within these groups. And Secretary Mayorkas has already testified under oath that at least 42 people with connections to terrorists have come in. But what's coming in the unguarded? You mentioned the gotaways earlier. Yeah. Who's coming in those sections that aren't protected?
This is a question to which we must return with you very soon. This is really scary stuff. Thank you for the work you do at Numbers USA. Chris Jamielinski, keep it up. I know you will. And I look forward to our further visits and insights into all of this and the corrective actions we must take. Next up, we'll speak with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry about a whole another set of problems, nuclear threats from Iran, among others, right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. We seem to have dodged a bullet last week at the World Health Assembly. No, it wasn't the 9mm kind President Biden wants to restrict. Rather, it was one Team Biden aimed at our sovereignty via proposals to let a proxy for the Chinese Communist Party dictate what constitute public health emergencies of international concern and what we'll do about them. Unfortunately, world government types are sure to resurface this gambit in the future. Worse yet, the global resetters simultaneously meeting in Davos unveiled two new digital mechanisms for imposing their totalitarian ambitions. As a courageous freedom fighter named Dr. Naomi Wolf has warned for over 2 years, such vaccine passports will inevitably usher in what the CCP calls a social credit system. Her brilliant new book, The Bodies of Others, is an instant bestseller and required reading for American patriots. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. We're going to talk now about a problem that we have, I think, paid altogether too little attention to of late. It is a project of the Biden administration to get back into some kind of nuclear deal with the nation of Iran. Despite a lot of terrible experience with previous deals with the Iranians, and despite the fact that in order to get into such a deal, the United States government has been behaving in a manner that I think can only invite the contempt of our adversaries, not just the Iranians, but also the Russians, who in the middle of our difficulties with them over Ukraine, we are relying upon to assist us in negotiating this so-called Iran deal 2.0. A man who has been deeply knowledgeable about nuclear weapons programs and capabilities for decades, going back to his time as a Central Intelligence Agency analyst, and then as a member of the professional staff of the House Armed Services Committee, and then as a staff member of several commissions, including one on strategic forces and another on the threats to our electric grid, is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, a great friend and colleague, very appreciated contributor to this program, also a member of our Committee on the Present Danger, China. And he's written recently about this Iran deal as being a risk we cannot live with, and I'm anxious to get his thoughts on it. Dr. Pry, welcome back to Securing America, sir.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Frank. And I would add that the Biden administration policy on seeking a new nuclear deal with Iran is also earning the contempt of our friends in the Middle East.
Indeed. No, you're right. It's an equal opportunity contempt generator. Peter, talk a little bit about the threat as you see it. If the Iranian program is not actually stopped, how dangerous is it? And are we right to be concerned that whatever the administration is trying to conjure up now is unlikely to stop that nuclear program?
Well, I'm of a minority view, but it's a distinguished minority view that includes, you know, former CIA Director Woolsey and Dr. Graham, who was the White House science advisor and ran NASA, and Fritz Ehrmacht, who was Reagan's chairman of the National Intelligence Council, and Ambassador Henry Cooper, several others who believe Iran already has the nuclear weapons and that they've probably had them since 2003, and they've probably weaponized the Shahab-3 missile, and that unlike North Korea, which has acquired nuclear weapons for purposes of diplomacy and blackmail and has advertised its program every step of the way, the Iranians have deliberately concealed their program because they're more dangerous than North Korea, that they have profound ideological, religious reasons for wanting the bomb that has to do with destroying the infidel powers, and that they plan to use it someday. And so that this has been a fool's paradise, this idea of pursuing an arms control agreement to basically disarm Iran of nuclear weapons because they've had them for a long time. And I think the scientific technological case is very hard to deny, but nonetheless, Washington has been in deep denial about this for a long time.
If that's so, and let's say for the purpose of discussion that it is, Peter, two things. One is, typically, nations, especially nations like Iran, have sought to establish their nuclear capabilities publicly, for example, North Korea, in the belief that it will protect them from efforts by countries like ours to seek the removal of the regime. So it's a little surprising, given that, you know, we have intermittently been about that, that they wouldn't take advantage of it. And secondly, I guess the question is, if the problem of a nuclear Iran is as serious as successive American governments have said, wouldn't we have seen, if they have this most dangerous of all weapons, them wielding it before now?
Not necessarily. To go to the first point, you know, about, you know, why would they not openly use their nuclear weapon, test it, or advertise its existence in order to protect their regime? They're not a normal nation state. You know, the mullahs who run Iran is a theocracy, and they believe God is on their side, and we are in the end, and that they are destined to win this struggle. Attitude is medieval. They have a 12th Imam conference every year in Tehran to look at the signs and portents. And these include, you know, not just the alignment of stars and things like that, but what's happening in world affairs to decide, is this the moment? Is this the time that they should use? This is, we have not. In fact, we have, we wrongly think of Iran as a normal nation state, even though it may be an evil nation state, but that it is run and managed the way normal nation states are, that think in terms of geopolitical and strategic interests and the like. And that is a big mistake. We need to be looking at Iran from the perspective of their own ideological perspective. Unfortunately, during the Bush and Obama administrations, people who were deep specialists in the ideology of radical Shiite Islam were booted out of their jobs, you know, because it was considered politically incorrect to look at radical Islam and how it moves it. So I think we've been blind to this threat, and what we regard as common sense analysis, like, well, surely if they had the bomb, they would have used it to threaten us by now. You don't do that if you actually plan to use it on a surprise basis. I mean, one of the things that I'm deeply concerned about, and maybe I'm the only one in the West concerned about this right now, is Iran possibly using a nuclear weapon in the war in Ukraine to try to convince the United States that Russia has used tactical nuclear weapons to try to trigger some kind of an all-out nuclear war between the infidel powers so they'll destroy each other. That's how the radical Islamists think, like in the Iranian Revolutionary Corps.
I think that point is well taken. Whether that scenario is reasonable remains to be discussed, I suppose. But I do want to just emphasize the 12th Imam is the guy they think is going to usher in the golden age of Islam, and their intent on bringing him back, which it seems requires them to help generate an apocalypse. We'll talk about all of this at greater length with Peter Pry on the other side of this very short break. Stand by. Welcome back. We are continuing a fascinating conversation, terrifying, but fascinating conversation with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, one of our country's foremost experts on matters nuclear, as well as the threats they represent to the rest of us. Peter, I did want to pivot from the Iranian problem, serious as it is, to another that you've spent most of your professional life warning about and working on, and that is the vulnerability of our electric grid. I thought you were going to say that your concern was that the Iranians, if they have a nuclear weapon, would use it to detonate an electromagnetic pulse over this country. And I know that is a concern, but talk, if you would, about what is the broader context at the moment for something that most Americans take for granted, which is that they will have endless supplies of electricity when we're being told, in fact, we may see blackouts across this country because of shortfalls in electric production or distribution for various reasons.
Right. I saw an article recently, and I had to kind of agree with the headline. It was something to the effect, why worry about a high altitude EMP attack, when we are basically destroying ourselves? And our energy policy, especially under this administration, is doing our adversary's job for us. And previous administrations also deserve blame. The failure to build new nuclear power plants, the failure to build new hydroelectric plants and new technologies to generate technology. Our country is growing and the demand for electricity grows and grows, but the infrastructure to provide that, is decades old and isn't keeping pace with demand. And now we're adding on to the burden of our electric grid, so-called green renewables, like, the solar and wind farms, which have no chance, no realistic technological chance of meeting the enormous demands we're playing. The Biden administration wants us to transition to electric vehicles, for example, which is going to put enormously strains on the grid. Even if they weren't doing that, solar and wind, not only can't they meet the demand, but they will destabilize the big grid the way they did in Texas, when the ice storm, the wind doesn't blow all the time, the sun doesn't always shine. And it makes the grid highly unstable and even more vulnerable to the kind of attacks I've been worried about, EMP, cyber attacks, physical sabotage that can cause a nationwide blackout. Well, we won't need to be attacked by an enemy if we keep going down this road. As you noted, they're actually predicting that we're going to end up having blackouts this summer. Those are self-inflicted wounds because of these bad policies.
Yes. I wonder, Peter, if we start having blackouts, and these are not to be confused with the intermittent interruptions, which all of us have experienced at one point or another, despite the overall incredible reliability of the grid by virtue of thunderstorms or trees falling on power lines or what have you, by and large, the power is on. If that is not the case, would you anticipate that this will catalyze at long last the kinds of steps that are needed to make the grid more resilient, as well as have increased capability to meet the needs that that we're talking about? Or will it take something worse to propel us into these sorts of corrective actions that you and Bill Graham's commission and so many others of us have been warning about for quite some time?
I think that depends, Frank, on whether we still have free and fair elections in this country anymore, and whether a future administration can come in that cares about the American people more than about green ideology. If this administration continues and the left keeps its death grip on the Democrat Party and the death grip on America and the American people, no, I don't think it'll matter. They want us to live with inflation now. They want us to live with these incredible high gas prices now as patriotic sacrifices. And they're secretly pleased with the high gas prices because that's part of the green agenda. The Even as Russia
drive us out of fossil fuels, as they say.
Right? They are doing things that are counterintuitive in terms of rationalism and common sense and logic. For ideological reasons. So I'm not persuaded that. I think they would try to make the case that that's the new normal. That we need to get look at California. California will be the future of the country. Unless the Democrat Party changes, which is unlikely, or unless you can bring into power again political leaders who care about the American people.
That's the crux of the matter. I think there's no doubt about it. But Peter, before that happens, or hopefully as a prelude to it happening, would you address one other piece of this, which is just infuriating to me, and I'm sure maddening to you as well? And that is vulnerabilities that we have built into the grid through techniques, for example, of importing from communist China, by some estimates, 300 of these large high-voltage transformers that are really the critical backbone and arguably the greatest vulnerability of the grid. This seems insane. Is it true, first of all, and is there anything we can do about it in the short term?
It is true. Unconfirmed but highly credible reports have said that they investigated at least one of these transformers and found a back door in it so that the transformer could be shut down potentially remotely. Even if that is not true, it's extremely imprudent to be buying transformers and, I would add, SCADAs, supervisory control and data acquisition systems. We've imported thousands of those. We don't know how many. But when your adversary has designed these things, he will know how to shut it down because we haven't designed them. They understand the systems that are on our critical infrastructure better than we do. That's like relying on China to build our aircraft carriers or fighter aircraft.
Even worse in a way, because it's the power grid for the entire nation. Peter Pry, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Your expertise, as well as your service to our country in all of these areas, is vital and so appreciated. I know you'll keep it up, and I hope you'll come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station, better equipped to help us in protecting the country we love. And then I hope you'll go forth and multiply.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.